In Myanmar, another military coup has ended 10 years of relative freedom. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, NLD, won democratic elections in 2015, and now she's back under house arrest, one assumes, who knows, after winning the November election for a second term, an outcome the military had called illegitimate. Since the coup, thousands of protesters have been injured, nearly 600 killed. Aymin Tan is a Yangon-based journalist, now in Bangkok, part of a Reuters team which won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. I asked them if there were signs of the impending coup.
So in the lead up to the coup, especially the last month or so, there were grave concerns that there would be a coup. The military, ever since the election, and really even before the election, the military as well as their proxy party, as well as parties that kind of align with the military, were voicing their concern about voter suppression, about the ways in which COVID restrictions could potentially suppress the vote, even unintentionally, as well as the election commission, which is appointed by the ruling government at the time, being biased towards the National League for Democracy, who is the party that appointed the commission. And in the last month, there were quite a lot of closed-door discussions between the National League for Democracy, as well as the military and their parties, concerning the election. And the military was making quite a lot of noise leading up to it about how they felt that the vote was unfair. But in the last week or so before the coup, they had seemed to essentially back off a little bit on their claims. People were concerned, saying, is the military threatening a coup? And the military spokesperson came out and said, we will obey the Constitution and we will respect the will of the people. And people interpreted that as them saying they wouldn't go so far as to stage a coup. But clearly, that's not what they meant at the time, or they were lying.
What if they weren't lying? Then what changed for them? In other words, why? Why this coup? The military was always in charge, one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a central question that people have been trying to answer. It's also been difficult to answer the question of what they were hoping and expecting would come out of the coup. You know, considering the mess that Myanmar is in now, you know, it's a little bit difficult to imagine what outcome they had expected when they staged this coup against an election in which 80% of the seats went towards one party and people seemed to be overwhelmingly supportive of the winning party. There's a few theories. One is simply that the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, was personally insulted, humiliated even, and he has had long animosity, public animosity towards Aung San Suu Kyi, and he is in his retiring year now, and you know, he expected to see better results for the military, for the military's aligned parties, and this was a sort of last-ditch effort in order to ensure that he personally would be able to continue to play a role in politics.
Aung San Suu Kyi is quite a contested issue outside Myanmar. She is seen as somebody who failed to protect the Rohingya people and in fact seemed to defend the genocide. How is she seen in Myanmar right now?
Aung San Suu Kyi has been revered in Myanmar really since 1988. You know, if you're talking to Burmese people about her in Myanmar language, you'll hear people call her mother or the lady or, you know, grandmother soon, depending on kind of the speaker's age. You know, she's really seen as a caring paternal figure to the country, and even if one isn't 100% aligned with her, one still needs to respect her and understand that she knows best, essentially. You know, in the early days of the coup, especially the first week or so, the people who were in the streets chanting were largely people who supported her specifically and her party. The majority of the chants you heard were about free Aung San Suu Kyi, we wish her good health. You know, Aung San Suu Kyi is our leader. And it took a few weeks for those chants and demands from protesters to begin to shift towards saying free our detained leaders. You know, we want democracy, we want a federal democracy, we want equality for everyone. And, you know, I think she has taken less of a center stage now that the coup is about 10 weeks in and people are seeing that there is a viable resistance without her. But even still, you know, she's still seen as this great moral and political leader that people deeply admire.
Are you able to shed any light on her position on the persecution of the Rohingya people?
So I think an important thing to remember about Aung San Suu Kyi is that she is part, or you know, her identity group is Bama and Buddhist. So she is part of the majority identity in Myanmar. And based on her statements and her writings in the past, it really seems like she believes in a Myanmar that is fundamentally Buddhist and based on Bama culture. Now, that doesn't mean that she necessarily thinks that other cultures should not exist or other religions shouldn't exist, but that they occupy a space in Myanmar that is more akin to a guest position as opposed to a fundamental part of the country. And so she has made statements in the past that in which she's used derogatory terms towards the Rohingya. You know, Western media kind of calls this term "gala" as Myanmar's N-word, when it's a little bit different. But you know, especially for the older generation, this is not considered derogatory. But a lot of younger people and people who are subject to be calling that term do, and so that's an evolving conversation. But she has definitely made statements in which she's essentially said, you know, if these people obey the laws, if only they came in legally, if only they would assimilate, you know, they wouldn't be subject to prosecution, in essence, victim blaming a bit. But she hasn't sort of explicitly said in any way that she hates them.
No, but this is not consistent with the kind of saintly reputation she has in the West.
No, it isn't. And I think in part, the West has a habit of creating these sort of perfect icons of democracy and goodness. You know, we see this with Gandhi, who, you know, in reality is a complicated person. And there are questions about his racism, especially towards Africans, and his questionable behaviors towards the women in his life. And so, you know, she's always been a complicated person. And I think in part, the West set itself up to be disappointed by her once she was free and able to actually act instead of just be, you know, this beautiful woman trapped by men with weapons.
She's back in house arrest or somewhere else now?
It's unclear. So she has not been able to speak with her lawyer or really communicate with the outside world beyond a few court appearances where she has appeared on video due to COVID restrictions for her trial date. The lawyer that her party has appointed for her says that she looks to be in good health, but it's unclear where she's being held, although it is likely she's under house arrest.
And she's not the only one. There's a large number of people who were in government, presumably most of them belonging to the NLD, and also opposition activists detained. I mean, a rough figure has been 3,000 and something. Is there any way of knowing?
We do have a decently accurate count of political figures and activists who have been detained, but there's also been quite a number of people who've essentially been disappeared, where the security forces and the military will not confirm whether or not those people have been detained. And there's also a number of people who they have confirmed are being detained, but will not disclose their location.
Did you believe that the transition to democracy was still on the rails and it was heading towards democracy? In other words, I suppose I'm asking, were you surprised that the military would once again clamp down?
I think Myanmar was headed in the right direction, especially considering the path it had been on for nearly 60 years under military dictatorship. But, you know, there's more to democracy than simply people being allowed to vote. And many of the reforms that people had hoped for with the introduction of elections, with the introduction of civilian-controlled government, hadn't come to fruition and seemed like they would take quite a long time if they were even being discussed. I think what was surprising, however, is that the NLD had seemed completely unprepared for the potential of a coup. So in the 5 years that the NLD had been in charge of government, their response to many more progressive activists and legislators who were pushing for more democratic change had been that if we move too fast, the army can conduct a coup. The army's ability to take over the government is embedded into the constitution that Myanmar had been under at the time. And, you know, it's quite surprising to me that this excuse, essentially, that they have been using for 5 years is something that they seem to have no contingency plans in place for, should the army decide to conduct the coup as they did in February.
What kind of contingency plans would have been possible? As you say, the constitution gives the military the right to call a national emergency without any civilian agreement, and maybe the NLD was right. Too many reforms would have provoked the military even earlier.
The military doesn't have the right to declare an emergency. That power rests with the president, which is an elected position. And so, you know, you would think that, for example, the NLD would have ensured that the office of the president and the security of legislators was not something that was controlled by the military. That's not something that is required under Myanmar law. That, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi herself would not be being protected by members of the military. I think there is also the question of, considering that there had been such grave concerns about a coup happening in the lead up to February 1st, which is the day the new government was meant to form, that essentially every elected official at the national level were gathered in the same place and were able to be arrested in one fell swoop, essentially, and no one had any sort of plan to ensure that they wouldn't have been, or at least had some idea of how they might escape, I think was very concerning and confusing.
Would it ultimately have made any difference, do you think?
I think it might have. I think the example of Dr. Sasa, Myanmar's special envoy to the UN, is a clear example of the difference it might have made for someone to have been able to evade arrest that first day and perhaps even get out of the country and work in exile to be able to speak freely, to not have their physical danger be under threat at all times. Dr. Sasa was in Naypyidaw that day that the coup happened, and he managed to escape. And, you know, we can see that he is a really important voice on the international stage right now for the civilian government of Myanmar.
And what's the international stage got to offer? The UN Security Council could intervene. Sanctions look like they have returned, placed by the US and the EU. What else could be done?
I think short of military intervention, which is highly unlikely, probably not a good idea considering the delicate nature of the situation at the moment. An important role that the international community can play is in whether or not they choose to recognize the junta as the government of Myanmar. I think we're seeing people begin to make that choice now. The UK has accepted that the civilian appointed Myanmar ambassador to the UK is no longer recognized as such, because they have received an official request from the military to remove that designation from him. And, you know, this essentially recognizes the junta as the government in Myanmar.
Does that seem extraordinary to you?
Yes. So I think in that situation, you know, the UK has been one of the leading voices in condemning the coup on the international stage. And it was quite shocking in that in their statement, in why they chose to recognize the junta as being able to make these sorts of decisions, they called them the government. And the UK, you know, in that statement said that they recognize states, not government. And it seems that they are essentially choosing to side with the military simply because it is sort of the path of least resistance, as opposed to really making a stand and sticking by their principles of working with and promoting democracy and democratic governance.
One of the things that the UN Security Council could do is to impose an arms embargo. Do you think that that's likely? Do you think that that would make any difference?
I think it would make a difference in that the Myanmar military has a lot of capital and access to capital. You know, despite their assets being frozen in foreign companies and in sort of foreign holdings and the sanctions that have come down, you know, Myanmar is still an extremely resource-rich nation, and they could exploit those resources in order to fund their continued occupation of the country and the government. An arms embargo would help at least ensure that they are not getting new and better and upgraded material, as well as restocking their supplies. It's difficult to say how likely that is. There is always the consideration of China and Russia, who have either vetoed Security Council actions or have tried to tone them down in order to create a story in which it's a question of both sides need to compromise or both sides need to sort of refrain from violence when very clearly it's the vast majority of the violence is coming from the military. But, you know, China has a vested interest in having a neighbor who has a stable government, right? If the people of Myanmar are continue to be subjugated to the sort of daily intense violence there, it could trigger a massive refugee crisis in which people flee to bordering countries, and China would be the recipient potentially of millions of people. But it's difficult to say how these countries will vote in the long run.
You mentioned the protests, and we've seen weeks of protests, some of which have died down now, perhaps gone more underground. We saw a general strike. I've read of consumer boycotts of the big earners for the military, which appear to be beer and cigarettes. Is the opposition qualitatively or quantitatively different from what took place in previous times, 1988, 2007?
Yes, it is. I think you're seeing a much more holistic movement of dissent, both in terms of how they're approaching the situation materially, as well as the makeup of the people who are in opposition to the military. In 2007, the main thing that people were asking for were economic reforms. And in 1988, people were asking for a chance to have elections. And both of these major demands didn't coalesce the entire nation around them. Right now, even if people are not necessarily completely unified in the things that they are demanding, you are seeing a situation in which ethnic armed groups that had not only come to fairly lucrative agreements with the Myanmar military in terms of the sort of resources they were able to exploit and the kind of control they were able to have over their populations, but were also fighting one another, have formed alliances and are working in concert to work with both the people in the regions that they are active in, but also people in the heartland of the country. And you are also seeing, especially with the consumer boycotts, a very unified front in terms of an opposition to the military, even if they're not necessarily pulling towards the same goal. Whereas in 1988 and 2007, you saw big specific groups kind of both leading the charge and being the makeup of the dissident movement. So in 1988, it was really led by students, and it was a lot of young people. In 2007, it was led by monks, and it was a lot of the sort of conservative establishment.
Are you optimistic about being able to go back to Myanmar in the near future?
I think in the near future, no. You know, borders have only hardened over time, and especially with the coronavirus situation, I think it's quite unlikely that it would be easy or safe, both for myself, where, you know, I might have to go into quarantine, which is likely to be controlled by the military, but also for the general public, if I was able to enter in a way that quarantine procedure could be avoided. Also, you know, Myanmar has been suffering from an economic crisis because of the pandemic, and the amount of people who are living in absolute poverty has dramatically increased in 2020, and that's only getting worse. You know, it's very possible that we could see a situation in which Myanmar becomes a failed state in the near future.
This is a weird question to ask a journalist, but if you were able to ask, for example, General Min Aung Hlaing why the coup had taken place, what do you think he would say?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know how much of the military's rhetoric and his rhetoric is genuine. Many people in Myanmar believe that everything the military says is a lie, that they care about money and they care about power. But the military styles itself as a protecting force for the nation, of ensuring that they prevent too much international corruption of Myanmar in terms of Myanmar culture, of Buddhism and Buddhist practices. And so, you know, I can imagine him giving a journalist the answer that he did this to protect the country. I have no idea whether or not he actually believes that, or if that is simply part of the propaganda effort.
And has the military addressed the nation? Has anybody said, look, this is what's happening?
Yes. So the military is now in control of essentially all of mass media in Myanmar. They control television, they control radio, the airwaves, and they control the essentially four newspapers that are still in print. Private print newspaper is essentially gone now. So the Myanmar public is receiving daily information from the military about why they did what they did, what they're doing now, and information about how the military is framing the protest and the people that have been killed. Min Aung Hlaing himself has addressed the nation on national television a couple times as well.
And what he said, that they are simply quelling violence.
The main line that the military has taken on why they have decided to take charge is that they are trying to safeguard democracy, that there was immense voter fraud during the 2020 election in November, that they are ensuring that the country does not fall into chaos, and that by, you know, taking control for 1 to 2 years as a sort of interim government during this emergency period, they are ensuring that there will be an actual free and fair election once they decide to give up power.
Is there any evidence of massive voter fraud?
There's no evidence of voter fraud to an extent that it would have changed the election results. That is the conclusion come to by both local as well as international election observers, as well as the election commission itself, which did conduct an investigation after the election when, you know, there were concerns of voter fraud being raised. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there was no voter fraud or voter suppression. there were definitely reports of people who were not able to vote for all of the offices that they were entitled to vote for because of, you know, paperwork errors, difficulty in signing up. COVID restrictions created very long lines in certain townships, but nothing to the extent that it would have made a difference in the election.
Are you worried about friends and family back in Myanmar?
Yes, I am, especially with the internet being more and more restricted these days. It's becoming more difficult to contact friends and family. And, you know, it's you want to ask people how they are, where they are, if they're safe. But the more information that they give, especially over insecure channels like text messages or phone calls, you know, the more you put people at risk. And so, you know, you don't even get to ask really how people are without, you can't really ask people how they are, where they are, unless without
giving up too much information.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you particularly careful about what you say to me? Or does that not worry you now? You're out.
It doesn't worry me as much now that I'm out. So there's a couple reasons for this. I'm a U.S. national. I was born in Myanmar, but I got U.S. nationality a few years ago. And so, you know, the Myanmar government or the Myanmar military has never really been one to target people who dissent to their actions, who are not Myanmar nationals, in the same way that you might see for Saudi Arabia or Russia, for example. You know, I also mostly publish and work in English, and the military right now is very busy quashing dissent among influential people who are writing in Myanmar language and other languages more commonly used in Myanmar. The last thing is just that most of my immediate family is not in Myanmar and are not Myanmar nationals. And, you know, even though the military does have a history of going after multiple generations of the same family, I'm lucky enough that that is much less of a risk for me.
That's Aimin Tan, formerly based in Yangon in Myanmar, now in Bangkok. You hear that Bangkok traffic in the background.